welcome to the Book Report. Or shall I say, howdy. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and we're galloping off today to explore a genre that's new for us, Tales of the American West. We'll listen to works of several classic writers and meet contemporary authors riding high in the saddle and high on the bestseller lists. Our trail takes us to colorful tales about fascinating people. So settle in and rustle up a comfy spot as we turn to page one of the book report.
Before we begin this week's book lineup, all of us at the Book Report want to send our condolences and prayers to the families of those affected by this week's tragedy at the Boston Marathon. What a horrible thing to have happened at an event that should have been a moment of triumph for the athletes and a culmination of years of dedication. We are so incredibly saddened. Now, back to the show, which I hope will offer some distraction. Winner of 5 Spurs, 2 Stirrups, and 3 Western Heritage Awards for his work, Lauren D. Estelman is among the great chroniclers of the American West. Book of Murdoch is the 8th novel in his popular Page Murdoch series. Deputy U.S. Marshal Murdoch is sent to Texas in 1884 to capture a gang of armed robbers. The wrinkle is that Murdoch must go disguised as a traveling preacher, toting a Bible in one hand and a pistol in the other. Richard Farrone narrates.
It was a clear, crisp day, a regular Montana particular. A little flinty, with the wind skidding off the snow caps on the divide, setting my face tingling, flushed as it was from the good liquor. It wasn't cold enough to cover my best suit of clothes with bear skin or even heavy twill. The sky hurt to look at. It depressed me beyond language. I'd buried my father on just such a day, and as I leaned on the shovel, all I could think of was the splendor he'd missed. How much better to go into the ground with the clouds as black as weeds and weeping. But no day is a good day to die. The Indians were as wrong about that as they were about everything else. The local loafers were all out enjoying the first stretch of pleasant weather since the sodden thaw, smoking, yarning, scratching at the lively activity on their long handles, and admiring the golden brown arc their spittle made as it cleared the hitching rails and splashed into the muddy street. I knew a few of them to talk to, but they all withdrew inside or down the boardwalk as I approached, as nonchalant as spooked antelope. What I had was worse than smallpox. I tightened my left arm against my ribs just to feel the solid lump of the Dean Adams in my armpit. A water wagon passed, spilling its inevitable leakage from staves inadequately treated with pitch. I waited for it to clear, then stepped off the boards to cross Bridge Street. I'd just come out of the shade of the porch when the shock came. I heard the crash and identified it even as I was falling. I hadn't counted on a carbine or that it would be fired from a second-story window of the Bannock Hotel on the other side of Main. The echo growled in the mountains as I lay in the mud, peddling one leg for a purchase I couldn't find. A crowd gathered around. There's always a crowd to be had, no matter how empty the street at the start. You can't beat blood or free beer for civic interest. I hoped they'd get the dates right on the stone. Hickok had made it only as far as 39, and mine is a competitive spirit. Part 1. Judge Blackthorne's Epistle to the Texicans. Chapter 1. How much do you know about the Bible? It's black, isn't it? Judge Harlan A. Blackthorne and I were seated in the library of the Helena Stockman's Club on Fuller Street, drinking claret with a shard of rye, the judge's own concoction, called Old Thunder's Gavel by the deputies who served him. The only book present was a hollowed-out copy of the Montana Territorial Code containing the pocket model Colt the judge carried in response to the latest threat against his life. The club's reading material stood in presses in the dining room, clearing space for its much larger liquor supply inside oak cabinets in the room where we sat. His expression betrayed a piety that didn't match his satanic features and pitchfork beard. But as usual, he shifted his annoyance to a less revealing subject. "Damn it, deputy. I know your prejudice against displaying the badge of office, but you might pay me the respect of wearing it in my presence." "Yes, Your Honor." I foraged it from a pocket and pinned it on. Blackthorne scowled whenever I addressed him by any title other than judge. Anything else didn't quite fit my mouth, although I could get out a proper sir in times of admiration. And I did admire him, but I'd take a bullet through the star before I'd say it. He was a vain old rooster who never forgot an insult or a compliment. He dismissed the shaft with a gesture that told me how deep I'd struck. I'd just returned from a messy errand in Oregon that had reflected badly on us both, as well as on the federal court, and I hadn't scrupled to remind him I'd been against it from the start. That I was there at all when I should have been on leave while tempers cooled said he needed me for something unpleasant, and I was determined to let him twist until he got to the point.
We've just heard The Book of Murdoch by Laura Nesselman. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook and your space? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Their professional designers come to your home, assess your space, and design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. Contact them today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. C.J. Box is a New York Times best-selling author. A native of Wyoming, Box lives outside of Cheyenne with his wife and three daughters. The first novel in his Joe Pickett series, Open Season, was included in the New York Times list of notable books of 2001. He's also written several standalone novels. He's won the Edgar, Anthony, and numerous other literary awards. Today, we'll speak with CJ about his newest title, Breaking Point. Welcome, CJ. It's so great to have you as a guest on the Book Report.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Breaking Point is the 13th book in the Joe Pickett series. For those who may not know him, introduce us to Joe.
Well, Joe Pickett is a Wyoming game warden, meaning he's a state employee, and he works in the Bighorns in Wyoming. There's a district that he's about 2,000 square miles with no backup, and he's in charge of, you know, enforcing the game and fish laws of Wyoming. But as in real life, he also gets involved in a lot of other kinds of cases and controversies and things that go on in that area.
All right.
He's married and has children and is pretty dedicated to both, but also has a weird knack of getting in the middle of great big things.
Well, your first Joe Pickett book, Open Season, was published in 2001. How did you come to be a novelist?
I was a journalist originally, journalism training. I worked as a very small-town newspaper reporter. And while I was doing that, which was great training, I found out later, I started working on a fictional novel for the first time. Took another 20 years to get the craft honed, and you know, between different jobs and moving around, but eventually came up with a manuscript that became Open Season, which was the first of the Joe Pickett novels.
All right. So can a reader jump into book 13, or do you recommend starting with an earlier book?
No, I think everyone in the series stands alone. Most of the readers who have read the entire series, say to new people they should start at the beginning, because the books do take place in real time and the characters are introduced in the first book. But I think they're all structured so that someone could start with any book, and hopefully they would want to read the additional ones.
What are the challenges you found in writing a series character?
Mainly, it's kind of technical, and that is that in describing the characters, the recurring characters, there needs to be some backstory for new readers, but not too much backstory for people who've read every book. and just kind of a, you know, too many references to things that have happened in the past without explanation can be confusing to new readers. So it's just kind of a balancing act to make sure that, you know, you can remind people who've read all the series of things that happened in the past, but not in so much detail that it's annoying.
Right. Well, give us an overview of the story of Breaking Point.
Like a lot of the Joe Pickett novels, this one's based around, you know, real events, real controversies, real issues in the Mountain West. And in this case, it's based on a court case that is still kind of ongoing, but turned a corner last year. And it was about it happened in North Idaho. The Environmental Protection Agency it went after a young couple who was building a home, and the EPA claimed that they were building it in a wetlands, although the couple, the Sacketts, had bought it in a established subdivision, had received, gotten all of the necessary permits, and was their place was surrounded by houses on all four sides. And it was done in such a way that the Sacketts never got a hearing, couldn't get a hearing, and couldn't find their place on the National Federal database of wetlands. And they the Sacketts were being fined supposedly $75,000 a day until they restored all the dirt. And EPA would not grant a hearing, wouldn't respond to their inquiries. Finally, a public interest law firm called the Pacific Legal Foundation defended them, and the EPA fought them all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court last year, and the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 in favor of the Sacketts over the EPA and that they should receive a hearing. And it was one of the most outrageous things I'd ever heard, because although we all want the EPA to go after big polluters and people who are destroying the environment, we don't expect them to go after individuals and fight them to such a degree.
Did the EPA give a reason as to why they went after the Sacketts?
You know, it was never very clear. The way the rules were written and the way their stance was, it was that, you know, they thought it was a wetlands. They didn't need to provide any proof for that. And it was up to the Sacketts somehow to prove that it wasn't, through a very expensive procedure that the Sacketts couldn't afford. So that was sort of the impasse, and that's what the court fights were all about, all the way up to the top.
And the Sacketts' neighbors in the development were never drawn into this case?
No.
Huh. That does seem strange. Well, which leads me to the next question. I'm sure opinions about the EPA differs across the country, the tree huggers, the East Coast versus West Coast. How has the reception of this book differed?
The reception has been extremely strong. You know, I think no matter where you sit, you know, politically, I mean, you can identify and hopefully are against this kind of bullying tactic against anybody by a federal agency. I mean, the right not to even have a hearing or any kind of due process just runs against just about everybody's grain, no matter what, you know, where you sit. And I think what I found is I keep hearing more and more instances of people who have tangled with different, you know, staffers from the EPA and feel kind of the same way. That doesn't mean that the EPA is bad in every case. They aren't. But, you know, it's a huge agency, lots of lawyers, lots of power, and a huge mandate. And, you know, there needs to be some oversight.
Well, I don't think I'm giving anything much away if I share that this book opens with a double homicide, which kind of leads to a discussion about gun control. In your experience, what's the difference in thought between East Coast and West?
Well, certainly in the Mountain West, you know, you can't really even say there's a gun culture. It's just the culture. Nearly everyone has firearms in their homes. That doesn't mean they all have, you know, semi-automatic rifles with huge magazines, but hunting, fishing, having guns around is just part of the natural culture and landscape, and not unusual at all. And the thing is, there aren't that many gun crimes or homicides in proportion to some places where, it's so contentious.
Well, in this book, of course, your inspiration was the Sackett case. So how much research did you do on them before you started writing?
I always do research so that when I tackle a topic like this, I can at least write knowledgeably, I think, hopefully, in a balanced way on both sides, so that both sides would say, yes, that's fair. In this case, I met with the lawyers who defended the Sacketts, and then even interviewed the Sacketts themselves to get kind of some of the inside information on what they went through personally, and what kind of sacrifices they had to make in order to defend themselves. I did read some transcripts and read the Supreme Court decision, which was so overwhelming in favor of the Sacketts that it was kind of hard to justify another side.
And did they move away from Idaho in disgust, or where are they now?
They're still there. They're still there. They still have not been able to build their home because what the Supreme Court decision gave them was the right to a hearing, which they had not been able to get up until that point. And it does look like the way the procedure all works out, that they will eventually be able to build. But that still may be a ways away.
Yeah. All right. Back to the book. Will Joe be back in another book after this one, or what's your next project?
Absolutely. I'm already working on the next Joe Pickett book, which the 14th, which will probably be out next March. But in the meantime, there's a standalone called The Highway that will be out the 1st of August, and it's a very scary story about a long-haul trucker who's a serial killer.
Ooh.
And again, the standalone, not a Joe Pickett book, but I'm pretty excited about it.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm looking forward to your next installment.
Thank you very much.
All righty. Bye. And now, let's listen to a sampling of Breaking Point, Book 13 in the Joe Pickett series, narrated by David Chandler.
Singwald noticed that Baker wore a wedding band, but he'd never heard the wife's name. Singwald had been divorced for 6 years. All he knew about Baker was, like thousands of others across the country, he was new to the agency and he was gung-ho to get into some kind of action. Baker was an EPA special agent, grade 12, one of 350-plus and growing. He pulled in $93,539 a year in salary plus benefits and hoped to move up to grade 15, where Singwald resided. Singwald made $154,615 per year, plus benefits. As they cleared Metro Denver into Broomfield, Singwald reached up with his left hand and loosened the knot on his tie and then pulled it free and stuffed it into his jacket pocket. When Baker saw him do it, he reached up and did the same. "Ties stand out where we're going," Singwald said. "What do they wear? Clip-ons? String ties?" "They don't wear ties," Singwald said. "They wear jeans with belts that say Hoss." Baker laughed. Then, "Who is this guy we have to pick up in Cheyenne?" "Somebody with the U.S. Corps of Engineers," Singwald said, shrugging. "I don't know him." "Why is he coming along?" "I don't know," Singwald said. "I don't ask." "The secret to a long career?" Baker said. "You got it." "Are there other secrets?" Baker asked, grinning a schoolboy grin. "Yes," Singwald said, and said no more. The agents drove another hour north and crossed the border into Wyoming. Instantly, the car was buffeted by gusts of wind. "Where are the trees?" Baker asked. "They blew away," Singwald said. As Singwald wheeled into the parking lot of the federal building in Cheyenne, he saw an older man in a windbreaker and sunglasses standing near the vestibule entrance. The man was conspicuously checking his watch and glancing toward them as they found an empty spot. "Gotta be him," Singwald said. "What was his name again?" "Love. That's all I know about him." The man who might be love pushed himself off the brick wall and walked slowly to their car. Singwall powered down his window. "You EPA?" the man asked. "Agent Singwald and Baker." "I'm Kim Love," the man said. "I guess we're going to the same place today." Singwald chinned toward the back seat. "Do you have anything you need to put in the trunk before we leave?" Love rocked back on his heels and hooked his thumbs through his belt loops. He shook his head. "I'll follow you up," Love said. "I've got my own car." "Sure you don't want to come with us?" Singwald asked Love. "I'm sure." "Suit yourself. Do you know where we're going?"
"Yes, unfortunately."
Singwald didn't react. Instead, he reached inside his jacket pocket and handed Love an official EPA business card. "My cell phone number is on there. Give me a call when we get going so I have yours, so we can keep in touch if we get separated." Love sighed and shook his head. "What? You think you're entering no man's land?"
"Yes," Baker whispered, sotto voce.
"Maybe we can stop in Casper for lunch," Love said. "I know a place there."
"We'll follow you," Singwald said with a shrug. When Love walked away to climb into his own sedan with U.S. government plates, Baker said to Singwald, "What's his problem?" Singwald shrugged. "Don't know and don't care," he said. "He's just another working stiff like us."
We've just heard Breaking Point by C.J. Box. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. A legend of the genre, Louis L'Amour was born Louis Dearborn L'Amour in 1908 in Jamestown, North Dakota. His father was a large animal veterinarian, local politician, and farm equipment broker who'd arrived in the Dakota Territory in 1882. Although the area around their home was mostly farmland, cowboys and livestock often traveled through Jamestown on their way to and from ranches in Montana and the markets to the east. After a series of bank failures devastated the local economy, Dr. L'Amour took the family first to West Texas and then all over the Southwest. Young Louis met a wide variety of people, the inspiration for characters in his later novels. Louis traveled the world but returned to his family home in Oklahoma in the early 1930s. There, he changed his name to Louis L'Amour and began to write. He had some success with poetry, articles on boxing, and writing and editing sections of the WPA Guide to Oklahoma. And he served in the Army in World War II. During the 1950s, L'Amour had his first real successes. His short story, The Gift of Cochise, was printed in Collier's Magazine in 1952. John Wayne and Robert Fellows purchased the screen rights and changed the main character's name to Hondo Lane. The rest is history. L'Amour eventually wrote 89 novels, over 250 short stories. There are more than 320 million copies of his work in print. Today, the Book Report will preview a great title from L'Amour, Comstock Lode. It was just a godforsaken mountainside, but no place on earth was richer in silver. For a bustling, enterprising America, this was the great bonanza. The dreamers, the restless, the builders, and the vultures were lured by the glittering promise of instant riches. They survived the brutal hardships of a mining camp to raise a legendary boom town. But some sought more than wealth. There was Val Trevelyan, a loner haunted by a violent past, and Gritta Redaway, a beautiful actress driven by an unfulfilled need. Together, the two fiercely independent spirits rose above the challenges of the Comstock to stake a bold claim on the future. Eric Singer narrates.
Val himself had gone into the mines at the age of 12, as did most boys. but it was the change in him that led his father to move. That and some drive within himself that asked for better things. The day the Trevelyans left for Gunwallow was a memorable one. Jenkins, the owner himself, had come around to the house to ask his father back, a thing unheard of, with all the village watching from behind doors and curtains.
"Leave now, man, and you cannot come back. I will not have my men coming and going."
"I shall not come back," Tom Trevelyan said. "There are mines over the sea, and I shall have one of my own."
"Fool's talk. What do you know of gold? You're a tinner and a copper man, maybe, but gold, 'tis another thing."
"I can learn."
"Have you money enough, then?"
"We put some by, and I'll sell the house." Val stood beside his father, a proud lad to see it, for never before had the owner come down to a miner's cottage to ask after any man. His father looked the owner in the eye and said,
"Why don't you come yourself, then? Sell this and come out to California.
This," he waved a hand, "is but a teapot operation to what you will find there." This made the owner angry.
"A teapot operate?"
"You're a canny man," his father said. "You would do well, yon." Jenkins grunted his disdain.
"You dare to advise me? You'll starve over there, if you manage to leave at all. You will starve or drown, or be killed by savages."
He started to turn away, his back stiff with offense.
"You've been given your chance to forget such nonsense, but now I'll not have you. Go then, go."
Jenkins strode away down the street, anger and damaged pride in every step. His father had turned to see his mother smiling.
"Ah, Tom, if starve it is to be, I shall starve a proud woman. Who would think to hear the owner told so completely? You are a bold man, Tom."
"I shall needs be bold. Do not think I go lightly from here, Mary. We shall face trouble. But now we will go to Gunwallow."
"You will sell the cottage?"
"I have spoken to Edward Bain, the new man who keeps the shop, and he would be having it from me, and a fair price, too."
Val had looked up at his father then and asked,
"Is it far to California?"
"It is far. Very far, I am told."
"Will we go upon a ship?"
"A very small ship, I am afraid, with very many other people. Then, when we get to America, I must find work, and when we know what we are about, we must buy a wagon."
"A wagon?"
"Aye. One is needed for the crossing of the Great Plains. We will need cattle for the drawing of it, and a horse for riding, and a rifled gun for shooting game."
"But what of the wardens?"
Mary protested.
"There are no wardens. The game run wild for any to hunt who will."
"Have you shot a rifle?"
"I have not, nor have I so much as held one in my hands. Here in England only the great landowners may hunt, so the only guns I have seen were in the hands of soldiers. But I shall learn. We all must learn."
"Father, what are plains?"
"It is like a moor. It is grassland, miles upon miles of it, with no trees but those along the streams, and there are few streams."
"Tom, is it as far as London, to cross the plains, I mean?"
He looked at her, smiling.
"Will Holder, you know, he who returned to Helston for his family, he said it would be 5 months in the crossing, perhaps 6.
He paused.
"It is very far. We must carry with us all we will need. It will cost us dear to go to California, Mary, but it will be worth it. Do you remember Will Holder? He left here with nothing, and when he came back he wore fine clothes, had new boots, and with money to spend."
They went down the road in the morning to Gunwallow by the sea, and they went to the house where Mary Trevelyan was born and where her brother Tony still lived.
That was Comstock Lode by Louis L'Amour. Before his phenomenal fame as a mystery writer, before Maximum Bob and Get Shorty, Elmore Leonard wrote westerns.
Leonard was born in New Orleans in 1925. His father moved the family to New Mexico in 1947. In 1949, Leonard began writing Western stories and selling them to magazines like Argosy and the Saturday Evening Post. Leonard was drawn to Westerns because he liked watching Western movies and he hoped to sell to Hollywood. For source material, he focused on the cavalry and Apaches of southern Arizona in the 1880s. He wrote 5 Western novels and 30 short stories in the 1950s, 2 of which became movies, The Tall T and, of course, The 310 to Yuma. Today, the book report will preview the complete Western stories of Elmore Leonard, including the famous Trail of the Apache, Blood Money, and 310 to Yuma. An ensemble cast narrates.
They rode around front, and Rich Miller came out of the Centralia to join them. He'd been sitting at the window, asleep, the clerk thought, wearing off a drunk. He was used to having riders do that. When the rooms were filled up, he didn't care. But Rich Miller suddenly came alive and swung onto a mount the Mexican was leading. So all that time, he must have been watching the front to see no one sneaked up on them. McKelway said a boy ought to be allowed one big mistake before he was called hard on something he'd done. Besides, Rich Miller's name didn't bring any reward money. Tuesday morning, the 20-man posse was deep in the Cofas. Gray rock towering on all sides, wild country, and now no trail. Freehauser decided they would split up, climb to higher ground, and wait. Just look around. He sent a man back to 4 tanks to wire Yuma and Aztec in case the outlaws got through the Cofas. But Freehauser was sure they were still in the mountains somewhere. Wednesday morning, his hunch paid off. One of McKelway's men spotted a rider, and the posse closed in by means of a mirror flash system they'd planned beforehand. The rider turned out to be Ford Harlan. Wednesday afternoon, Ford Harlan was dead. He had led them a chase most of the morning, slipping through the man net, but near noon he turned into a dead-end canyon, a deserted mine site that once had been Sweet Mary No. 1. Ford Harlan had been urging his mount up a slope above the mine works toward an adobe hut perched on a ledge about 300 yards up when Freehauser cupped his hands and called for him to halt. He kept on. A moment later, Jim Mission, McKelway's deputy, knocked him out of the saddle with a single shot from his Remington. Then McKelway and Mission volunteered to bring Ford Harlan down. McKelway tied a white neckerchief to the end of his sharps for a truce flag and they went up. Freehauser had said, if you want to get Ford, you might as well go a few more steps and ask the rest if they want to give up. They were almost to the body when the pistol fire broke from above. They scrambled down fast, and when they reached the posse, Freehauser was smiling. They were all up there, Eugene and Deke and the Mexican and Rich Miller. One of them had lost his nerve and opened up. You could see it on Freehauser's face, the self-satisfaction. They were trapped in an old assay shack with a sheer sandstone wall towering behind it, thin shadow lines of crevices reaching to slender pinnacles, and only one way to come down. The original mine opening was on the same shelf. Probably they'd hid their horses there. Freehauser was a contented man. He had all the time in the world to figure how to pry them out of the dobe. He even listened to McKelway and admitted that maybe the kid, Rich Miller, shouldn't be hung with the others, if he didn't get shot first. Some of the posse went back home because they had jobs to hold down, but the next day, others came out from Asuncion in 4 tanks to see the fun. It seemed natural that Deke should take over as boss. There was no discussing it. No one gave it a thought. Ford was dead. Eugene was indifferent. Sonny Navarez was Mexican, and Rich Miller was a kid. The boy had wondered why Deke wasn't the boss even before. Maybe Deke didn't have Ford's nerve, but he had it over him in age and learning. Still, a man gets old, and he thinks of too many what-ifs. And sometimes Deke was scary, the way he talked about fate and God pulling little strings to steer men around where they didn't want to go. He was at the window on the right side of the doorway, which was open because there was no door. Eugene and Deke were at the left front window. He could hear Sonny Navarez behind him, moving gear around, but the boy did not take his eyes from the slope. Deke lounged against the wall, his face close to the window frame, his carbine balanced on the sill. Eugene was a step behind him. He was a heavy-boned man, shoulders stretching his shirt tight and tall, though Deke was taller when he wasn't lounging. Eugene pulled at his shirt, sticking to his body with perspiration. The sun was straight overhead, and the heat pushed into the canyon without first being deflected by the rim rock. The Mexican drew his carbine from his bedroll and moved up next to Rich Miller. And now the four of them were looking down the slope, all thinking pretty much the same thing, though in different ways. Eugene Harlan broke the silence.
I shouldn't have fired at him.
It could have gone unsaid. Deke shrugged.
That's under the bridge.
I wasn't thinking.
Deke did not bother to look at him.
Well, you'd better start.
We've just heard the complete Western stories of Elmore Leonard. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. Larry McMurtry's epic cycle of novels of the American West began with the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lonesome Dove. His novel Buffalo Girls, which we'll preview now, begins with Martha Jane's letter to her daughter back east. Martha Jane, better known as Calamity Jane, is just one of the handful of aging legends who traveled to London as part of Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show. As he describes the insatiable curiosity of Calamity's Indian friend, No Ears, Annie Oakley's shooting match with Lord Windhovern, and other highlights of the tour, McMurtry turns the story of a band of hardy, irrepressible survivors into an unforgettable portrait of love, fellowship, dreams, and heartbreak. Betty Buckley narrates.
You will be a mother someday, Janie, and have your sorrows too. Who can outrun sorrow? Not me, Janie, and not Dora Dufresne. Not since Blue married Granville Stewart's pretty little half-breed daughter. I hope no man will do you so, Janie. I don't even want to think about it. Dora tried yesterday to give me Fred. She says I need a friend and a parrot's better than nothing, but I wouldn't take him. He's not a bad parrot, though he can't say anything except General Custer, who taught it to him, or why he wants to say it, I don't know. You'd think living with Dora all these years, Fred would have learned a more interesting stock of words. Not that they'd be words I could put in a letter to you, Janie. It's my pride that I can afford to send your daddy money so you can be raised among decent people, not the riffraff and ruffians you'll find out here these days. There are people who would include your mother in such a description. In fact, most people would. But I didn't take Fred. I think Dora would miss him. She's the one who should be thinking of parrots better than nothing, because Fred and nothing's about what she's got. I have Rag and Bone. They are my true friends. Why they would think there might still be beaver down in the Shoshone country, I don't know. It's a sign to me that the boys have drunk one too many rounds. If there were beaver along the old Wind River, why wouldn't the Shoshone have eaten them? What else did they have? What it's really a sign of, Janie, is that people can't give up hoping for what they once had. Youth or you name it. When Jim and Bartle came west, the west meant beaver. Now they're old, and the beaver had been gone for 25 years, but the boys can't admit it. At least Jim can't. They still think there's a creek somewhere boiling with beaver that God saved for them. It's just how people are, Janie. They cling to foolish hopes. But you will need to be studying your lessons and not wearing out your eyes reading my old gloomy words. Don't worry about your mother, Janie. I have always got by. I'm hardy. I scarcely even coughed after sleeping in that mud puddle, though I admit, if it had been later in the year, I wouldn't have been so lucky. I've got my young horse Satan and my buffalo dog. Satan's a good horse, and the dog Cody is a fine hunter. Often he'll bring a rabbit, and once he brought in a badger. I didn't know about eating a badger. I took it to my friend Mrs. Elk Shoulders, and she cooked it in a hole in the ground. It tasted fine. I called the dog Cody after Billy Cody. Buffalo Bill, I guess you've heard of him. There's a man with luck on his side if there ever was one. He'd have been dead years ago if it wasn't for luck. He ain't tough. There's hundreds of Indians who could kill him easily, but he's still alive. Billy's been writing lately. He's trying to get me to go with the Wild West show he started. But I ain't that desperate, I guess. I am the Wild West, Janie, no show about it. I was one of the people that kept it wild. Why would I want to make a spectacle of myself before a bunch of toots and dudes? Not me, Janie. I'd rather sleep in a mud puddle every night and rowdy it up with Blue and the other cowpokes. Good night, Janie. I'll stop. I don't want to scribble on and wear out your pretty eyes. Your mother, Martha Jane. Chapter 1. Jim Rag was skinning a prairie dog, wondering if the fire would last until he got it skinned. A Wind River breeze, a gale by most standards, surged down the gray canyons and sucked at the fire. "Let's go somewhere else," Bottlebone suggested. "Right in the middle of supper?" Jim asked. "No, I just meant eventually," Bartle said. "There's grit and then there's Wind River grit, and I prefer the first kind." "I think this prairie dog might have been sick," Jim said. "It moved kind of sluggish like you do when you're sick." "Well, if it was sick, I prefer to go hungry," Bartle said. "I'm not up to digesting a diseased animal tonight." Bartle was combing his fine beard. Among his few treasures was a fragment of comb he had snitched from a whore in Cheyenne. His beard was another treasure, at least in his view. Many Western beards were filled with dirt, grease, and bits of debris, but he strove to keep his immaculate. No easy task in a rough, often waterless land.
We've just heard Buffalo Girls by Larry McMurtry. The Great Taos Bank Robbery and Other True Stories of the Southwest is a classic collection of nonfiction essays about life in New Mexico by the great Tony Hillerman. Hillerman was born in Sacred Heart, Oklahoma in 1925. In World War II, he served with distinction and earned the Silver and Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart. From 1948 to 1962, he worked as a journalist, then he taught journalism at the University of New Mexico. Hillerman wrote more than 30 books. Titles from his beloved Navajo Tribal Police series are special favorites. Here, in a wonderful nonfiction collection, Jack Garrett narrates the stories that unveil the life and magic of the Land of Enchantment.
The newsroom of the New Mexican first got word of the incident about 10 minutes after 9, the morning of November 12, 1957. Mrs. Ruth Fish, who had served for many years as manager of the Taos Chamber of Commerce, and almost as many as Taos correspondent for the Santa Fe newspaper, called Collect and asked for the city editor. She told the city editor that the Taos Bank would be robbed that morning. She said that she would walk over to the bank and watch this operation. She promised to call in an eyewitness account before the first edition deadline at 11 a.m., The city editor asked how Mrs. Fish knew the bank was to be robbed. Mrs. Fish, in a hurry to get off the telephone and become an eyewitness, explained very briefly that one of her lady friends had stopped in her office and told her so. The lady was now waiting so that they could walk down together and watch. But, the city editor insisted, how did the lady friend know the bank was to be robbed that morning? Because, Mrs. Fish explained with patience, the two bank robbers were standing in line at this very moment, waiting their turn at the teller's cage. But, persisted the city editor, how was it possible to predict that these two persons intended to rob the bank? This presumption seemed safe, Mrs. Fish said, because one of the two men was disguised as a woman, and because he was holding a pistol under his purse, whereupon she said goodbye and hung up. While astonished by the foregoing, the city editor recalled later that he had no doubt at all that the bank would indeed be robbed in the fashion described. If the reader feels less sure at this point, it is because the city editor had two advantages. First, he knew Mrs. Fish, an elderly woman of dignity, charm, and grandmotherly appearance. She possessed a flawless reputation for accuracy. Second, he knew Taos. While bank robbers probably wouldn't stand politely in line with the paying customers in Omaha or Atlanta, there was no reason to believe they wouldn't in this peculiar little town. As a matter of fact, they were doing exactly this, and their courtliness was about to cause them trouble. The chain of events that followed did not reach its semi-final anticlimax until 60 hours later, and was not officially ended until the following February, when the federal grand jury met 65 miles south in Santa Fe. By then, the affair was being called the Great Taos Bank Robbery. Lest the reader be misled by this title, he should be warned that Taos also lists in its litany of notable events the Great Flood of 1935. If the reader can accept the fact that Taos managed a great flood without a river and with the very modest amount of water available in its arid climate, he is prepared to hear more about what happened on November 12, 1957. After the city editor collected his wits, he placed a long-distance call to the bank. The secretary who answered didn't know anything about any bank robbery, but she referred the call to a higher-ranking official. The city editor asked this gentleman if his bank had been robbed. "Certainly not," said the banker. "How in the world did such rumors get started?" A few minutes later, Mrs. Fish called back, slightly breathless. She reported that she and her friend had walked through the alley behind the Safeway store and arrived at the bank just as two men with drawn pistols dashed from the front door. One of the men was dressed as a woman, as previously reported. He ran awkwardly in his high heels. The two jumped into a green pickup truck, parked in the alley, and drove away. From what she had learned from spectators fortunate enough to arrive earlier, the two men had not taken any money from the bank. She would investigate further and call back. Mrs. Fish, a woman of impeccable courtesy, hung up without a word of reproach to the city editor for causing her to be late for the event.
We've just heard The Great Taos Bank Robbery and Other True Stories of the Southwest by Tony Hillerman. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Best-selling author and New Mexico native Michael McGarity takes listeners to the wild territory of the late 19th century American Southwest in his epic tale, Hard Country. After the deaths of his wife and brother, John Kearney gives up his West Texas ranch and heads west in search of a new home. Soon, Kearney is offered work trailing cattle to the New Mexico Territory, a job that will forever change his life. George Guidel performs the work.
She ran her hand over the cradle at the foot of the bed. John had built it during a late winter blizzard that kept them inside for 3 days. He spent time working on the cradle until the storm broke and the weather cleared, joining the wood perfectly and rubbing it smooth to the touch. He wanted no splinters or rough edges to harm the baby boy he hoped to see sleeping there. Never had he made anything so nice for her. When the storm passed, it took a week to count their losses. In the bone-cold days that followed, harsh northern winds blew across the vast West Texas plains, exposing the dead animals buried under snowdrifts. To Mary Alice, the grotesque, frozen carcasses scattered across the land was a scene from Hades. As the carcasses thawed, the wolves, coyotes, vultures, and crows congregated to feast. The screeching and squealing of the feeding animals, their howls, yips, and caws, made her uneasy and fretful. Outside the cabin, the stray dog John had found on the open range started barking again. Mary Alice didn't bother to get up to see what had set it off. It barked all the time at nothing. John let it sleep in the cabin, and most mornings it left a mess that had to be cleaned up before she started breakfast. She kept hoping a coyote or wolf would make a meal of it, but it stayed close to the cabin, barking, barking, barking. She hated that dog. John had given it a name, but Mary Alice refused to remember it. More than once she'd considered shooting it, burying it far away from the cabin where John wouldn't find it, and telling him it had run away. She absent-mindedly caressed the cradle again, trying to remember what she'd been thinking about. Ever since the fifth month of carrying the baby, she'd felt deathly tired. Her legs ached from morning to night, and she had constant pains in her back. The heat of late summer days, with not a trace of rain for weeks, had worn down her thin, small-boned frame even more. The baby had kicked hard all day, but suddenly shifted and stopped moving about the time she'd started dusting. Although her water hadn't broken yet, earlier she'd sent John to fetch his sister-in-law, Ida, to help with the delivery. The angle of the sun through the open door told her they should arrive soon. She wasn't looking forward to having a baby. She had tried hard to match John's happiness over the prospect of a son, if it was to be a boy, but secretly she felt no attachment to it. Living on the empty, lonely Texas plains had carved a hole inside of her. She forced herself to act glad, but it was all make-believe. She didn't fear childbirth. She'd seen her mother and an older sister go through it and knew what to expect. The baby would come when its time was due. It would be painful, bloody, and she would be sore for days, but that was simply the way of it, and nothing could be done to change it. What she fretted over and feared the most was the stark reality that she had no interest in the child at all. Was she mad? Daft? She dreaded the rest of her life. The dark cabin, the empty world outside, the endless work with little sleep, caring for John and the baby day in and day out, the possibility of more children. She had tried repeatedly to make the baby real in her mind in the hopes that she could learn to love it. She thought about nursing it, caring for it, dressing it, playing with it, teaching it. But her indifference never went away. She closed her eyes and tried to picture a happy baby, but all she could think of was how big and uncomfortable her breasts felt, how alien her body had become. She didn't like it at all.
That was Hard Country by Michael McGarrity. The year is 1878, peak of the Texas cattle trade. The place is Dodge City, Kansas, a saloon-filled cowtown jammed with liquored-up adolescent cowboys and young Irish hookers. Violence is random and routine. When a burned body of a boy named Johnny Sanders is discovered, part-time policeman Wyatt Earp is shocked, and Doc Holliday takes it as a matter of personal importance. In Doc by Mary Doria Russell, we meet the beautifully educated Southern gentleman, Dr. John Henry Holliday. At age 22, he's given an awful choice: die within months in Atlanta, or leave everyone and everything he loves in the hope that the dry air and sunshine of the West will restore him to health. Young, scared, lonely, and sick, he arrives on the Texas frontier just as an economic crash wrecks the dreams of the nation. Soon, with few alternatives open to him, Doc Holliday, who had been trained as a dentist, becomes a professional gambler. He travels to Dodge City, where his unlikely friendship with Wyatt Earp begins. The gunfight at the OK Corral will forever link their names in American frontier mythology. Mark Bramwell narrates.
As far as Wyatt Earp knew, it was not illegal to beat a horse. In the past few years, he'd worked as a part-time policeman in a string of Kansas cowtowns. Each time he was sworn in, he made an effort to study the ordinances he was supposed to enforce, but he wasn't much of a reader. In Ellsworth, he asked a lawyer for some help. "Wyatt," the man told him,
The entire criminal code of the state of Kansas boils down to four words. Don't kill the customers.
Most of the time it seemed sensible to keep things just that simple. It was, after all, a long way from the cattle roundups in South Texas to the railheads of Kansas. There were dozens of ways for a cowboy to prove his mortality before he got that far. He could be trampled in a stampede or get himself gored by a cranky longhorn. He could be rolled by a spooked horse or break his neck falling off one. He could get snake bit. He could drown crossing a river. He could die of ptomaine poisoning or bloody flux. A cut could go bad. Sometimes that's all it took. Once they got their herd to town, drovers collected their accumulated pay, and it was whoop it up, Liza Jane. After 3 months of relentless labor, enduring bad weather and worse food, sleeping in their clothes unsheltered on the ground, when they thundered into Wichita or Abilene or Ellsworth, Wyatt guessed that those Texas boys could be forgiven for presuming that such places existed for no other reason than to show them a good time. Certainly Kansas businessmen did nothing to discourage the illusion, what with the Longhorn this and Alamo that and Lone Star the other on every sign on every saloon and whorehouse north of the Arkansas River. Dodge City's leading men were especially ardent about conveying the splendid reception Texans would receive should they elect to follow the Great Western Trail to the southwest corner of the state. All winter there were advertisements in Texas newspapers to that effect. Bob Wright's General Outfitting store offered to send supply wagons south to provision cattle companies along the trail, for a small fee, of course. And Bob himself was so accommodating he'd take a cattleman's word as bond for payment. When the long, hard drive was done and the herds were delivered to Dodge, weary cowboys would find clean, comfortable rooms at the Dodge House Hotel and enjoy excellent dining at the Delmonico Restaurant, Deacon Cox's proprietor. Big George Hoover declared his intention to reduce the wholesale prices of liquor and tobacco during the entire cattle season, just to make those fine young Texans feel right at home in every saloon in town. Mayor James Dog Kelly assured them that the attitude of the townspeople toward high spirits was tolerant and friendly. Dog himself was a veteran of the Confederate Army, and his recent election to Dodge City's highest office was proof that Southerners would receive fair treatment there, not like in those East Kansas towns where unbearably victorious Yankees would likely cheat those Southern boys every chance they got. Some of that was even true, mostly, but it wasn't comradely fellow feeling that accounted for the welcome Dodge extended. The facts were these. Dodge City did not invent or manufacture goods. Dodge did not raise or educate children. It did not nurture or appreciate the arts. Dodge City had a single purpose: to extract wealth from Texas. Drovers brought cattle north and got paid in cash. Dodge sent them home in possession of neither. Dead men don't pay for baths, haircuts, meals, or beds. Dead men don't buy new clothes or ammunition or saddles. Dead men don't desire fancy Coffeyville boots with Texas stars laid into the shank. They don't gamble, and they don't spend money on liquor or whores. And that was why when the Texans got to Dodge, there was really only one rule to remember. Don't kill the customers. All other ordinances were customarily negotiable. So Wyatt was pretty certain it wasn't illegal to beat a horse. It was just stupid and mean.
We've just heard Doc by Mary Doria Russell. Readers, we've come to the end of the trail, though I know I've enjoyed this exploration of Westerns. Whatever your favorite genre, when you're looking for a great new title, check my website, bookreportradio.com.
I hope you've enjoyed our journey, but before we ride off into the sunset, let's make a date to meet back here next week on The Book Report.